Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking episode number 800 of this program with gratitude to all of you who have listened and made it possible. World War II is a seemingly inexhaustible topic. The more you learn about it, the more you realize how much more there is to learn. And new generations are learning about it in different ways today. Come October, when the Air Force Academy squares off with the Naval Academy in college football, the story of the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo will reach a whole new audience because Air Force will be wearing some of the coolest uniforms I've ever seen. A Doolittle Raider-themed jersey and helmet combo complete with the serial numbers of the 16 B-25s that took off from the USS Hornet all those years ago. If you're a longtime Hometown Heroes listener, you may recall an episode from Missoula, Montana, with a Doolittle Raider named David Thatcher.
We had the Hornet and then two cruisers and four destroyers and a tanker. There was just eight in the task force when I left there. And we got just out of San Francisco a ways, and then they announced over the loudspeaker that our destination was Japan. And there was a huge shout went up over the whole aircraft carrier. No one had said anything about where we were going up until then.
Had you had your suspicions that it might be Japan? I'm sure that's where everyone wanted to attack.
We thought that's where we'd be going, yes.
And again, the genesis of this was got to find some way to strike back at the Japanese. Not as much for the physical damage, but for the psychological damage to show the Japanese they could be hit and give America a morale boost. I bet you didn't quite have that all figured out yet at that time.
Not at that time, no.
Anything of note that stands out to you between when you left the Golden Gate and when you got to that morning of April 18th when the mission actually happened?
The Navy wasn't very well pleased with having Army personnel aboard, but after they treated us pretty well. They let me sleep in a bed instead of a hammock.
So you get closer and closer to April 18th, and as I understand it, the events of that day actually got triggered sooner than they were supposed to. Surprise, surprise. Funny how that happens in war. Tell me how that developed.
Before that, we met up with another small task force, and it had the carrier Enterprise. It also had two cruisers and four destroyers and a tanker. And Hornet could not launch or recover its aircraft while we were on board. So they had the Enterprise along to try and protect the task force from aerial fighting.
That's a pretty good security blanket. You know what the Big E went on to do the rest of the war and had been there at Pearl Harbor outside the harbor too. Well, let's move along to that morning, April 18th. Did you have any butterflies that day? How much did you know about what you guys were going to be doing? Walk us through that day as you experienced it.
Well, we knew what our target was. Each of the pilots got a chance to pick what target they wanted. So, and our target was the Nippon Steel Factory in Tokyo. But that morning, we heard the sort of explosion, the guns going off, and immediately they announced over the loudspeaker, "Army pilots, man your plane." So we had to get ready and go up on deck.
Did that get your blood pumping a little bit, get you excited?
Yes, it did.
I can imagine how it would. And as I understand it, Doolittle made the decision to leave 10 hours earlier because your task force had been detected. So this added 170 miles on a range that was already at its limit, right?
I think Bull Hall pretty much made the decision that as long as we run into a Japanese fishing boat out there, that we're afraid they'd warn Japan that there was a task force out there. So we had to take off then.
What was it like on your crew as you guys took off? Did you have any idea how historic a mission this was going to be?
None whatever. We figured just another bombing missions.
But this is obviously your first mission.
Yes, for every one of us, yes.
So you weren't nervous at all?
Just pretty excited.
Was there anything that you guys did, maybe said something to each other, said a little prayer, talked about this or that, or were you all just keeping your mouth shut because you all knew what you were doing?
And had to concentrate on what we were doing, yes.
And what were your duties? I know the plane had 400 or 500 pound bombs, but you're on that top turret gun, so are you just looking for enemy aircraft to shoot at, or what?
I would just keep a lookout. I had 250 caliber machine guns in the turret, and I could see everything from up there in all directions, so I had a ringside seat.
So I've heard these B-25s, these heavily modified B-25s, described as flying gas cans. Was that something that you guys used as a characterization or something that you've heard since?
Probably something heard since.
But you knew that crazy mission, that you were not going to make it back to the ship. Was that clear to you beforehand?
No way of ever coming back to the ship. We couldn't land on the aircraft carrier. We just had to go ahead.
So you were hoping to drop your bombs over Tokyo and land somewhere. And tell me about how this played out. What was it like approaching your target? What was the mood when the bombs were dropped, and what happened after that? I'll let you just tell the narrative for a little while.
Well, we were flying just 50 feet over the water. As we came in over the beach, it was Saturday, right at noon, a beautiful day, and there's hundreds of people along the beach. So as we flew overhead, they were waving to us. I could see the expressions on their faces as they were cheering. I'm sure they thought we were Japanese planes. After we left the coast, then before we got to Tokyo, we met a formation of six planes. But we were flying so low that it's difficult to see an airplane that's flying right over the ground. With the olive drab color they were, and they passed overhead, and I guess they didn't even see us. They just kept on going direction we were coming.
But you saw them. You knew they were coming. So you were probably at the ready on your 50 calibers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then before we got to Tokyo, we could see the anti-aircraft fire exploding because we did not go in formation. We went in alone. So six of the other airplanes had been ahead of us, so they drew the anti-aircraft fire. Then we had to climb to 1,500 feet to drop our bombs so they wouldn't blow us out of the air when they exploded. We had three 500-pound demolition and one 500-pound incendiary cluster. The three 500-pound demolition went at an angle down to the target, but the incendiary cluster, when it fell out of the airplane, it scattered into 126 individual bombs to scatter over the area that had been exploded from the other bombs, so to start fires. There wasn't quite a bit of anti-aircraft fire over Tokyo itself, but it wasn't very accurate. I guess they hadn't had any practice yet.
Well, yeah, just like Pearl Harbor was a sneak attack, a surprise attack, this was every bit as much a surprise attack, and there were probably a lot of people, like you said, that thought they were Japanese planes. But I'm trying to put myself in your shoes and in your head, and you're already flying this flying gas can, as I said, with a range that it's not designed to make. You can't come back to the ship. You don't know where you're going to land. You see six planes coming at you. You know there's probably more. It sounds a lot like a suicide mission. Did that ever occur to you that this might be a suicide mission?
No, we didn't plan on that at all. We figured we could reach China all right, even though we had to take off 250 miles farther out than we'd planned to. Our original plan was to take off in the evening and fly over Japan at night and reach China the next morning after daylight. As it was, we had to take off at 9 in the morning. We rode over Japan in the daytime and then finally arrived on the coast of China. It was about dark.
I'm really intrigued by that period of time between when you dropped the bombs and when you landed, or crash landed as the case happened to be. At what point did you realize this is it? The gas has run out, or we've got to put it down? Was there any discussion among the crew? Did you guys just all trust Lawson to handle it, or what were those moments like?
No, we figured he could handle it, whether we tried to land in the water or fly up high and bail out.
When did you find out that he was going to put it in the water, that this was it? And tell our listeners where that was and how that all happened.
Well, we finally reached what we saw land, and he spotted a strip of beach, and he thought they could set it down there. So we had the wheel down, but it was almost dark and raining, and visibility was poor. And we hit the water with the wheel down, and immediately stopped us and turned us over.
What did that feel like? I can't imagine.
Well, I was knocked unconscious for a while, and I was in the back of the airplane. The other four were all thrown out through the nose of the airplane. When I came to in the back of the airplane, I wasn't completely conscious, and I could see water coming in what I thought was the bottom of the airplane. So I tried to get out there and then come to realize the plane was upside down, and the plexiglass on the turret had shattered, and that's where the water was coming in. So I was able to go back and open the escape hatch on the bottom of the airplane, crawled out on the belly of the airplane.
Which was now the top.
Yes. And then walked back towards the tail of the airplane, and when I stepped off in the water, it was about waist deep. So I was able to wade to shore. By that time, the other four crew were already up on the shore. They were very seriously injured, and there was some people up on a bank there, and they heard the crash, so they came down there, and we didn't know if they were Chinese or Japanese, but the first thing they wanted to know, we couldn't understand it, but they pointed to the fingers on their hand, and then they point to each one of us, and then they point out to the airplane. So they figured by that they wanted to know if there was just the five of us in there. So then they helped us up to a little village there overnight.
I don't want to interrupt you here, but and I know that you, like every veteran I've interviewed, are very humble about what you did. But the government gave you a Silver Star for what you did, and tell me what you did with the other four men, because from what I've read, you had to help them significantly with first aid and making sure that they'd got off that beach.
We went down on a Japanese-occupied island off the coast of China, but the underground there helped us get out of there. And the next morning, then, none of the four of them could walk, so they had to be carried on makeshift stretchers. We had to cross the island, so they used a bamboo, sort of a bamboo pallet to tie up to a bamboo pole, so two coolies could carry each one of the guys on their shoulders. And the guerrilla leader on the island there, before I left, I went back to the airplane after daylight and tried to find a first aid kit. But then I saw that the airplane was upside down, the main landing gear was sticking up in the air, and the engines and propellers were quite a ways out in the water. But we must have hit the bottom when we crashed, because the full front end of the airplane, clear back to the leading edge of the wings, was smashed flat. So if they hadn't been thrown out, they'd have never got out alive.
So were you able to find some materials to render first aid?
No, I couldn't find anything but packs of cigarettes floating around in the plane.
That might have made someone feel a little better, but it wasn't going to do a whole lot of good. So you, along with these Chinese nationals, helped the injured guys. You weren't banged up at all? I know you were just not even 21 yet, just 20 years old, but you weren't hurt at all?
I was had a pretty bad bump on the top of my head from, that's what knocked me unconscious, I guess. But otherwise than that, I was not hurt.
So what's going through your mind at this point? I mean, there are so many moments where you probably thought this could be it, but did you think you were going to get out of there alive? I mean, I can't imagine what it must have been like to you in that situation.
We didn't know if we would or not. If it hadn't been the Chinese, we'd have been captured.
How did they get you out of there and back to Allied forces?
We left that spot where we crashed at 11 o'clock in the morning. We found out later that the Japanese landed 65 Jap soldiers, and they came looking for us, but we had a head start on them, had to go all the way across the island, and went by a sampan then to the mainland. It took us 2 days to get to free territory at the little town of Haiyu on the coast. Then it took us another day to reach a hospital. They had to be carried all that time.
I imagine everyone's getting pretty exhausted and probably pretty hungry by now, too.
Well, we did have some food, but they were in pain all the time because we didn't have and had nothing to relieve their pain or.
Would you say that's something, I'm sure the crew was close ahead of time, but at this point, do you think it brought the crew closer together to be going through this incredible ordeal together?
Yes, I'm sure it did, yes.
So what happened next? Where did they take you from there?
From the hospital, they got to the hospital, and there, we were there at Lin Hai for 3 days, and then another crew made a good water landing on an island out farther than we were. The airplane floated for 8 minutes, and they were able they had the only medical doctor that was on the raid with them, and they were able to get his black bag out and get the stuff into the life raft. But in landing in the water, a sharp edge of one of the flaps had turned up. As they pushed the life raft off the wing, it punctured one half the life raft and dumped everything in the water. So they were able to cling to the raft to get ashore. And they came to the island of Dandine where we were, and my co-pilot, Dean Davenport, had given his passport to the guerrilla leader on the island, so they knew we were ahead of them and needed medical attention. So they caught up with us at Lin Hai 3 days after we got there. And then I went on with their crews because I was no more used to my crew, and the docs Dwight stayed with their crew and to take care of them.
And all this time, I'm sure none of you had any idea how successful your raid was or what kind of significance it would have or what happened to all the other crews, right?
That's right. We didn't hear until we got a big city on the Yangtze River, Hanyang. We finally found out about the other crews there. So then I went on with that crew, and it took us a couple more days of pretty much walking and being carried in sedan chairs. The Chinese had blown up all the roads along the coast to slow the advance of the Japanese. So all there was trails down through the rice paddies that traveled.
This is not what you imagined when you're a Montana boy signing up for the Army Air Corps. What was that moment like when you finally saw American officers and enlisted men again and realized, you know what, I'm not going to spend the rest of this as a POW?
Well, at Lin Hai, there was an English missionary and his wife, and they could translate for us then, so that helped a lot. We finally reached Hanyang, and a good-sized city, after traveling almost every means of transportation you could think of. They had an airbase there. So we waited 3 days for an airplane to come in from Chongqing to pick us up. And those 3 days, the Japanese would come over and bomb the city and bomb the airport, because the Chinese didn't have anything to shoot us at the wheel. Every day we'd go up the river in a tug and get out on the shore and hike up to a pagoda on the top of a hill there. The fourth morning they came in and picked us up, the airplane got in. Well, that day, the Japanese came over and bombed and strafed that pagoda. They knew what we were doing. They had spies through there.
Man, close call after close call after close call. And one of the things that's most incredible to me is that so many survived. There were only a few, I believe, 8 ended up as prisoners of war. 3 were executed by the Japanese, which is a great tragedy. But the other tragedy in this, the Chinese that helped you. I've read as many as 250,000 civilians were killed by the Japanese to punish them for helping you?
Mm-hmm. They went through, and as they kept advancing, they'd wipe out the towns and villages that helped us, any of them. Yes.
I imagine that just has to really be hard to deal with and hard to swallow, and makes you that much more grateful to those people who did help you, who saved your life. And in the end, I imagine a lot of the people that helped you probably died, right?
Yes, that's for sure. I'm sure they did, yes.
I didn't ask you about the movie that came out, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. When that happened, when it came out, the war's still going on. Was it kind of a neat thing for you to see yourself on the silver screen?
When I came back from North Africa in January 43, I was stationed at Santa Monica, and I got to visit the MGM studios and meet all the crew that in the movie. That was quite interesting.
Once you got married, I imagine your wife enjoyed these reunions as much as you did.
Yes, we've been to a lot of the reunions throughout the United States, it seemed like.
People that go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and the National Air Force Museum there can see some of this, but you have some very special goblets that you drink a toast out of every year at these reunions. Tell me about that.
There are 80 goblets in a case that all of them have a name right when they're turned right side up, or when they're upside down, you can read our names on them. One for each member of the Raiders. And we drink a toast to all those that have gone before us. And then if any Raiders have died in the past year, their goblets are turned upside down at that reunion.
You've done this dozens of times, but I have a feeling that every year it's probably still a pretty emotional moment for you, is it?
Yes, as through the years, the number of Raiders has diminished quite fast, really.
And I've heard of this tradition with some other reunion groups, too. When it gets down to the last two guys at the reunion, tell me what you're going to do.
Well, there's a bottle of liquor that we're supposed to open it and drink a toast to all those that have passed on at the last reunion on two survivors.
David Thatcher was one of the last two surviving Doolittle Raiders and did indeed participate in that toast The story of those goblets will be included in the effort to connect that incredible chapter of history with a whole new generation when Air Force meets Navy on the gridiron in October. And speaking of reaching younger generations, I've got some exciting news to share about these veteran stories. Perhaps you can be a part of making this vision a reality. We'll talk about it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.